Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and I have the pleasure of bringing to you Janice McIntosh, who I have known for several years. Janice has expertise in a wide variety of clinical areas in nursing, including med-surg, GI, endoscopy, and more recently, home care. She's worked in home care agencies in four states and currently provides services as an expert witness on home care cases. Janice, welcome to the show.
Hi, Pat. Thank you very much for having me back.
This is the second part of a podcast that Janice and I did earlier, which was podcast number 439, in which we focused on some of the issues associated with home care given to Medicare patients. We are, in this case, going to focus a little bit more in the home care area, but looking at the skilled versus the non-skilled areas. And I think we should start there, Janice. I think when people hear home care, they think of it as this one unified type of service. What are some of the different pieces associated with home care?
Well, it's surprising to a lot of people that there are so many different types of home care, and the regulations sometimes cover more broad areas. So, for instance, there are home care cases in acute care, which we've talked about. That's the standard one that comes out of the hospital. Maybe they need dressing changes. Maybe they need some IVs for a week or two. Those are generally standard acute cases. Then there are Medicaid cases, and surprisingly enough, there can be skilled in those as well. Some states do have a skilled component to Medicaid, which Colorado, where I was working last, had that feature where you could go out and manage medications on a weekly basis, or sometimes even more frequently if they had a catheter that needed to be irrigated or something that required a nurse to do it. And then there's also long-term support services. So that might be a Medicaid waiver. There is a new trend in Medicare. Some of the managed care systems have started allowing a long-term support services type thing where you send out a homemaker, or maybe they just need someone to help them bathe three times a week. So there's that component. Also, private duty can be considered home care. And so there's a lot of sometimes issues in private duty with some patients require 24-hour care, and sometimes staffing that or you know, the standards of care can be breached easily in that. And then also sometimes group homes fall under home health care regulations. So there's a variety of different types of cases that can come up.
I remember how surprised I was when I first heard about the concept of children who are kept at home on ventilators on a long-term care basis, usually with the mother, exhausted mother, supplying right. some services and nurses supplying services on the other shifts. I don't know if we can even conceive, if we haven't been involved in your field as we have, of the intensity of technology that can be used at home and the responsibilities of the home care nurses. Have you seen cases or heard of situations where nurses at home have been pulled in as defendants on some of those technology issues that have gone bad?
Yes, I have seen ventilator cases. There was one that I worked with that the patient, it was a multi-layer type case where the patient was transferred into a wheelchair. He was ventilator dependent for when he was sleeping. So when he was up in the chair, he generally didn't need to have the ventilator attached. He was transferred to the chair, and the nurse, in the process of moving him into the bathroom, she had him on a very solid shower chair that had a tray top. And what we believe is that she leaned on the tray top, and the chair went over forward. He ended up with multiple fractures of his both femurs and some, I believe, a shoulder fracture. And also, once he was on the floor, of course, had to be lifted up, and they put him back to bed. And at that point, he desaturated and started turning blue. And the nurse who was working with him did not follow the standard of care and the plan of care, which was to turn his oxygen up and start bagging him with a resuscitation bag. And so she did start eventually, after a few minutes, to use the bag, but she never turned the oxygen up past 3 liters. So he did end up with some brain damage, and it was a complex case because they had to get a engineer in to give an opinion as to whether or not the chair was able to tip over on its own. She claimed that he had simply that the headrest had fallen, which made him jerk and threw him forward and caused the chair to tip over, which our engineers were, I was on the plaintiff's side, and our engineers were able to prove that that wasn't possible to do. And he also had multiple rods in his spine, so he only had about a 10-degree range of motion that he could move his back. So they could prove that he couldn't possibly turn the chair over without some sort of pressure on the front of the chair. So,
isn't that interesting how the engineers weighed in on that?
Yes.
Helped to refute the theories of the
defense. And on top of that, the nurse was a brand new graduate, which, considering the complexity of what he had going on, I opined to the fact that I felt that maybe she didn't have enough training, maybe that wasn't the correct nurse to put in there, because she didn't have that background of what do I do in an emergency. So that was a key piece to it as well.
I was just talking to somebody who I know who was placed as a new graduate into a critical care unit. And she was an extremely bright new graduate and one of the few who gets put into critical care without any experience right from nursing school. I always, as a nurse educator in charge of the staff development department of the hospital where I worked, went by an assumption that nurses started off in med-surg, they worked in a hospital, they got experience, they then went to critical care or maybe ER, or they went to home care where there wouldn't be anybody supervising them, watching what they were doing. I can't imagine how hard it would be to be a new graduate and to be assigned or to seek out a role working for a home care agency where you have no structure and no support.
Right. And, you know, I remember how scared I was when I first graduated and I was running to the next wing over to find a nurse because I had a bubble in my IV. So I can imagine, you know, being in a home care setting and having someone that is ventilator dependent and, you know, has there, when you have someone like that in the home, you have numerous pieces of equipment, suction machines, and we all know suction machines sometimes break down. You know, you have the ventilator, then you have Hoyer lifts, and sometimes those don't work right. So there's always that possibility of equipment failures as well.
Mm. And what kinds of issues have you seen come up with group homes?
So sometimes it's improper placement. You know, I had one where someone was taken from a nursing home and put into a group home where it is all non-skilled personnel. And he required a degree of oversight that they weren't able to provide. So there was that issue. I might have mentioned this in the other portion of my podcast, but he was a man that was on fluid restrictions. He had kidney failure. He was diabetic, and he was going around and drinking liquid soap in the group home because he was so thirsty and he had dementia. Mm. And so, you know, that factor was, I mean, he was just improperly placed.
That's what we call a high colonic, Jen.
I think so. I can't picture tasting soap.
Yuck. Yuck. Yeah. Soap suds enema, but being given in the wrong end of the body.
I don't even know that he diluted it with water.
Oh. So supervision, it sounds like supervision issues, placement issues are some of the things that you've run into.
Right. And failure to train the staff. You know, if you have someone who is thrown into a situation and just not properly trained, and, you know, we all know how difficult it is to get staff sometimes. And sometimes there's a desperation, especially in those private duty settings where you have to have somebody in there. And or a situation like the ones I worked at with the Medicaid, where you had CNAs going in four times a day. And that was what kept them out of the nursing home. And if you didn't have a CNA there to do the care, then they weren't able to go to the bathroom. They weren't able to go to bed, or they weren't able to get out of bed. And so sometimes you become very relaxed about hiring policies. So sometimes you have improper background checks, or not following up with previous employment to find out what sort of employee they were and why aren't they working there now. So, you know, there's that rush to get a warm body out there is sometimes what happens. And so in the process, there's all kinds of issues. There's the improper or failure to follow for oversight. That's the word I'm looking for. So there's supervisory visits that are supposed to be happening to make sure that they're doing proper care and that they're following the plan of care, because there is a plan of care no matter which, you know, whether it's a group home, private duty, or in a skilled setting. So, you know, they need to be following the plan of care. And failure to do maintenance on equipment. So I had one where they had an overhead Hoyer lift that they were not able to maintain properly, or they didn't maintain properly, and they got a very heavy guy up in the Hoyer lift, and he came crashing down and ended up with some fractures from it. Mm. And this is the same poor guy that had another failure of equipment. He was living in a group home, and he was going to a day program, and at the end of the day program he was being loaded back up on the bus, and they, number one, did not do the maintenance on the lift, so that there's a foot pad, like a foot pad that flips up when the lift starts to go up. And that didn't work on this one. And there's also a failure by the staff to secure the wheelchair. So he went up in the air and then the wheelchair started to roll and off it went. And so it was about 4 or 5 feet up off the ground when the wheelchair went flying off the lift. And so it was a multiple defendant case where they were charging that the bus service didn't maintain their bus properly, and that their personnel weren't properly trained in order to secure the wheelchair, and then also the lift situation with the group home. So there was a couple of things going on there, but ultimately the guy did end up passing, and from his injuries off the second when he plummeted off the transportation. So,
you know, Jen, that would be what we would call a 2-for-1 case.
Yes. Unfortunate 2-for-1.
You remember that cartoon when we were kids? There was this little guy who carried, was in Little Abner. He had a cloud over his head.
Yes.
His name was Joe, I think. And everywhere he went, there were clouds and lightning going down towards him.
Yes.
To laugh about him, but there are people who can't seem to catch a break, so to speak.
I know.
Poor guy.
Know. Exactly.
I worked on a group home case of a man who was unsupervised smoking. He was laying in bed close to midnight and borrowed cigarettes from his roommate and fell asleep. You know that expression, don't go to sleep, don't lay in your bed and smoke, because you can fall asleep. He didn't learn it somewhere along the way. And he set himself on fire and ultimately died from his burns about a week or two later.
Wow. Yep.
I also ran into a couple. It was in one of the conferences that I attended, which I didn't ever think about. A young woman and her husband who thought that opening up a group home would be a wonderful way to make money. And they had this old family house that they renovated. And they were, at the time I met them, were inviting people to come in and live there. I didn't think about the economics of this. And it makes me wonder about the motivations of individuals who open up a group home. They might be very dedicated to the people, or they could be focused on, well, let's staff this with the least expensive people and get the most money that we can from the residents of the group home, and we'll just make a bundle.
Right. And, you know, that was my feeling about the case with the man that had kidney failure and was drinking soap. He was eventually put down in a room in the basement with a roommate, wasn't coming out of the room, and he became more and more bedridden. Staff was not checking up on him to find out why. They were just accepting when he said no, he didn't want to come upstairs for meals, and they would bring a meal down to him, but that they didn't monitor how much he was eating. The long and the short of it is that he ended up walking on a needle, and the needle pierced his foot. He started complaining of pain in his foot, and he was even observed by a nurse practitioner that was making her monthly rounds, and she felt the redness was a blister. Didn't order any kind of x-rays or follow-up, antibiotics, anything like that. And the long and the short of it is he ended up in the hospital about a week and a half later. And no one from the group home was paying attention to what his complaints were. It was just simply, oh, well, you know, leave him in bed and he'll be okay. And he ended up losing his leg and eventually ended up losing his life. So so it progressed to that stage where it was tragic. And unfortunately, that group home is still open. So.
Yes. Well, let's switch our focus a little bit. Legal nurse consultants could be involved in helping attorneys look at home health care cases. What kinds of documentation would they expect to find in a home health chart?
Home health charts look a little bit different. It's sort of like doing a nursing home case. The documentation is going to be a little bit different, and some of the pieces of it will look like what you see in a nursing home case. There's something called a 485, which is actually the set of orders. And it is the documentation that talks about what their diagnoses are and what any and all orders, their medications, their treatments, even what your expectations for their discharge are. And you have a month from the time that they're admitted to get that to the doctor and get it back, which seems kind of funny because, you know, in no other situation that I can think of, do you have a month to get an order signed by a doctor. But because of the lag time in sending things out, things have gotten much better with electronics. But, you know, the old system of flying it through the mail and then waiting for it to be signed and sent back to you, and you did everything you possibly could to hand feed everything to the doctor with little arrows where they're supposed to sign. And those are getting better now with electronics, but it's still, you know, that requires follow-up. So sometimes you're acting with no signed orders, and you have to look at the date that the doctor signed it and the date that they were admitted and see if for an entire month they were working without signed orders or more. I've, you know, had situations where you just couldn't get the doctor to send them back. Were they following the visit frequency? Because there will be a notation on there how often the nurse is coming out, how often the physical therapist is coming out. Generally, they'll even put down there on what days of the week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or if it's going to be every other day, it's 3 days one week and 4 days the next week. You have to follow the frequency. You need to follow the plan of care. There should be a plan of care, just like any other nursing situation, and they need to be following that plan of care. And if they're not, and their treatments are deviant. I've had one where they just opted to go completely rogue and follow their own care plan. So you do have to be aware of that. You look for visit notes. They should have a visit note for every single visit that they did. The medication record. Every time that there's a change in the medication, you have to send an order back out to the doctor to get, you know, if you come into the home and you find that, oh, I have a new pill bottle, you need to mark that down on what's called a telephone order or a verbal order and send that out to the doctor to make sure that that gets signed and sent back. And phone calls, are they communicating appropriately with the doctor? CMS came out in 2017 with new regulations for the way that home care communicates. And so you need to make sure that that communication chain is following up with the doctor, following up with the supervisor. If the home health aide finds something unusual in the home, I've had cases where the home health aide found a sore but didn't report it to the nurse. The sore kept getting worse. Nobody reported it to a supervisor, a nurse, or anything. And then, of course, it never followed up that they called to the doctor to get orders for treatment. Also, in skilled cases, there's teaching that's involved. You know, any new medication, did they teach on that new medication? did they follow up to make sure that interactions were appropriate with the medications that they were already on? I'm trying to think of other things. There's the OASIS. The OASIS is, I'm sorry, I can't remember what the acronym stands for, but it's a very long, it's like the MDS in nursing homes. It's a 24-page document that goes on and really goes into great depth about what their abilities are. Are they able to get up and go to the bathroom by themselves, or how much assistance do they require? How incontinent are they? Are they just when they sneeze, or is it when they, all the time? And that also, that document gets transmitted to the states, to Medicare and Medicaid. And so they do get that transmitted, and when they come out to do audits on an agency, they are going to have your how much, like, let me back up a little bit. So they have the I'm trying to remember what it's called. Online, you can look up the home care agencies that have good ratings, and those are based on the findings that you find in the OASIS. So if an agency doesn't have a lot of improvement in care, then that gets transmitted. The complicated thing is that I know for most of the Medicaid stuff that I have worked with, you don't have the OASIS transmitted the same way. And so you don't have those standards that are the same in Medicare versus Medicaid. So a non-skilled agency doesn't even have a OASIS. So that becomes complicated when you're doing a case, is what kind of case am I working on and what kind of documentation should I be looking for? And if that OASIS isn't there, is that appropriate? Or is it an error on the part of the agency? The admission documentation, they have to have an emergency. All agencies have to have some sort of an emergency care plan. So those are some of the most frequent ones I would be looking for. Then, of course, when you start getting into asking for further documentation, you want to do chart audits. If you are suspecting that there might be some documentation failures, you're going to want to look for there are still some agencies out there that do have handwritten documentation versus the electronic stuff. So you want to make sure that you've got everything from the record. The emergency preparedness plan has become a big issue in a lot of agencies, because there is a requirement that it's not just I know where my exits are. It's a case of, I know that if I have to be permanently evacuated, this is where I'm going to go and who's going to help me to get there. So those are some key things. And also, when you are looking further, you want to look for training records. Obviously, policies and procedures, if you have that availability, but training records can tell you a lot. Were they appropriately trained? Were they trained on an annual basis? Were they supervised appropriately? There should be supervisory records. Um, so So there's a lot of complicated stuff that you don't won't find in a hospital case.
Mm-hmm. Boy, it sure sounds like it. There's so much that goes into looking at the care that's occurring behind those closed doors.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Jan, we have reached the end of our time, and I appreciate everything that you have shared. How can our listener find out more about you, your services, how to reach you if the individual watching this has need for a home care nursing expert?
So my email address is jmcintosh@gmail.com. And my web address is macintoshlegalnurses.com.
All right. Well, thank you, Janice. I appreciate that. I've learned some things today, and I think you've got great expertise and experience to be able to help attorneys and other legal nurse consultants in pulling apart some of the nuances associated with liability issues in home care. Documentation certainly is different than acute care or long-term care, and it requires a certain level of skill. Especially, I found in reading OASIS admission assessments that they could be extremely lengthy and not always provide much information, much like electronic medical records where you get lots of paper, lots of pages, but sometimes not too much useful information about a case.
Right.
And thank you to you who has been watching this show. Be sure to go to legalnursebusiness.com and pick up our free reports. Be sure to come back next week. We'll have a new show, or click on down if you are listening to more than one show in a row. We welcome your opinions and appreciate your participating in our shows. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. Diane Tomacelli and I have just been speaking about electronic medical records. Diane, what will our listener or our viewer get as some key concepts that we talked about in your podcast?
Well, Pat, we talked significantly about some of the misconceptions for electronic records. We talked about the definitions of what a hybrid record is, and that it's not just meaning paper and electronic. It could be multiple systems. We talked significantly about what a legal nurse consultant can do to help review those records. And we also had an in-depth discussion on audit trails. An in-depth discussion on audit trails and how to be very specific when you ask for them.
Why don't you start your sentence again? Because I talked over you.
The whole thing again?
No, we also talked about, because I can edit this part out.
Okay. We also talked about in an in-depth discussion on how to look at audit trails, because audit trails can be very deceiving and you may end up with a whole lot of data that you don't want to get. So being very specific is very helpful.
And I have found that many attorneys and legal nurse consultants lack knowledge about audit trails. So you'll want to pay particularly attention to Diane when she speaks about audit trails and the ways that attorneys and legal nurse consultants should phrase the request when they are asking for the facility to put together an audit trail.
Absolutely.
Be sure to listen to Diane Tomacelli's podcast on electronic medical records. You'll enjoy it. You'll get some concrete information from it. And come back next week for Diane's show. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Pat.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.